During this week at the booth, a lady said to me, I had said something about the Bible. Do you do the Bible? Something like that. And she replied to me, you don't believe everything in it, do you? And I thought I understood what she was asking. And so I answered what I thought she was asking. I said, yes, I do. And she said, and it's a defense for her position. She's trying to defend her position. And what she asked me next is this. She said, you don't believe in all those Jewish dietary restrictions, do you? How did I answer?
Yeah, for the Jews.
Yeah, for the Jews, right. And where did I turn to show we're not under that law anymore? I didn't go to Hebrews.
Galatians.
I didn't go to Galatians.
Acts.
John always gets it.
You must have been wrong.
could have.
It's not what goes into a man that makes him a sinner or causes him to sin.
Okay. Right. No, I didn't go there. I went to Colossians 2. You're right. It was a little test. Hebrews would have been fantastic. Galatians, somebody said. Great place to go. I mean, this was just a conversation. It was just another conversation. And we could go to a couple different types of conversations like this. But if you're out there having conversations, somebody's going to ask you, "What? You don't believe the law? Or you don't really believe the whole thing, do you? And then why not? You're being inconsistent." She was going for, "You're being inconsistent." And I was countering with, no, the Lord put that law on the cross, if you will. Okay. We're at the end of our study of the law. Before we go on, 3 weeks ago, I think it was, I said something about talking about Deuteronomy 24 and something else. We're not going to get to Deuteronomy 24 first. We will get there, but not first. Okay. First, I want to talk about adultery and polygamy, and a connection between the two, okay? So adultery and polygamy, just kind of hang out for a second. I'm going to throw up two statements. I'm going to read them, then I add to them a little bit so that we kind of hopefully understand at least what Lee is saying. All right, the first statements are, in the old law, a married man could not be charged with committing adultery against his own wife. The second statement is, in the old law, if a married man had relations with an unmarried woman, he just took her to be another wife of his. Okay, let's fill in a little bit. In the old law, a married man could not be charged with committing adultery against his own wife because adultery against his own wife could not even happen. Against his own wife could not even happen. A man, when he was charged with being an adulterer, was charged for facilitating another woman's breaking her covenant with her husband. Okay? There's an expression, men can only break another's covenant, women can only break their own covenant. Is that relatively clear what we've said so far? Maybe that last statement isn't, so just strike that. Okay, so in the old law, if a married man had relations with a married woman, they were both condemned to death. But if a married man has relations with a woman who is not married, he tried, according to the language of Exodus, he tries to take her as his wife. If she refuses, or the father refuses, then he just pays a dowry. But he tries. So let's say he's successful. He has relations with a woman who is not married, who is not his wife. He gets her as a wife. What do we call that? Polygamy, which means what? Yeah. Okay. That's relatively clear so far. Now, when we come to the new law, if a man has relations with any other woman than his lawful wife, he is committing adultery against his own lawful wife. Turn to Mark 10. In other words, what we're getting at, there's a big change between the Old Testament and the New Testament. It has several ramifications, but the one I'm really referring to now is polygamy. So what did I say, Mark 10? Yeah. So Mark 10... we'll just read verse 11 because I think that most of us are familiar with the context here. He said to him, to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another woman, and does it say that woman's married or not?
No.
It's just any other woman. He commits adultery against her. Okay? That under the old law, that would not have been stated like that. It would have been stated very differently. It would have been stated, if she were married, then they commit adultery. And it wouldn't even say against her, right? That was different in the old law. Okay, so in the new law, if a man has relations with any other woman besides his lawful wife, he is committing adultery against his own lawful wife. Is that clear? Nothing big so far? It's not clear.
It's clear.
It is clear. And nothing big so far, right? No huge changes. Okay, so the relevance of this to polygamy is this. Under the old law, a husband could have relations with a woman other than his, and I put in brackets, first wife. I'm not saying that he has a first wife which he leaves and gets a second wife. I'm saying that he marries a wife, that's her first one, and then he throws on another wife for 2 and 3 and 4 and 5. Okay. In the old law, that was okay. But in the new law, under the new law, a husband cannot have relations with any woman who is not his first and really only wife. Does that make sense?
As long as she's alive.
Yes, as long as she's alive. Right. I say first in parallel to first over there, okay? But in the New Testament, in the Old Testament, you could have a first and a second and a third. In the New Testament, you can't have a first, second, and a third. You have an only, okay? So that's one way that you can argue against polygamy. And there are also other ways, one of them being there's no statement, command, example, or necessary inference that polygamy is authorized in the New Testament. Yes, you can go to the Old Testament and see it's in there, but are we under the Old Testament? Obviously not. Okay, so next time you're somewhere and need to preach on it, you're maybe more prepared now than you were before. I'm not sure. And this is real, right? This is real stuff that people and some evangelists and some Christians must deal with this. Comments or questions on this? Yeah.
What if he doesn't divorce them and just marries another one?
Because
it says divorce.
Okay. So there's no scanning. There's no statement, command, example, or necessary inference. Right. Okay. In other words, you can't go to the language of the New Testament and get out of that it's okay to marry multiple wives or multiple husbands either, right? Okay, so about Deuteronomy.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So for example, like 1 Corinthians, he's condemning the, is he doing that based on principles of the old law or something new? Or could you prove that in a way or does it matter? The one that has his father's wife or whatever.
Oh, 1 Corinthians 5.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, I just wasn't. Usually when you're talking about this kind of thing, it's 1 Corinthians 7, but you weren't going there.
Could it be proven and or does it matter? But if it does matter, can it be proven whether or not he's saying this is wrong based upon Old Testament law principle or something new?
Well, this would be new. This would be not even the Gentiles do this thing. So it's
okay.
Right. It doesn't have to do with the law of Moses specifically. Even Gentiles wouldn't do that. Okay. So Deuteronomy 24. Way back in Deuteronomy 24. Verse 1. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house. I asked the question, if you remember it, what is actually the command? Do you remember that question? Now, if you're reading out of the King James, who's reading out of the King James tonight? I don't think anybody here is. Oh, there you go. All right. The language in the King James is going to be a tiny bit different than the language in every other version we have here. In the King James, it's going to say, then. So, if he finds some indecency in her, then he writes her a certificate of divorce. And I think there's a full stop or a semicolon there. There's a hard stop after certificate of divorce. Is that true? Oh, 24:1, Deuteronomy 24, verse 1. After it says, because he has found some indecency in her, then he writes her a certificate of divorce, and full stop, or semicolon.
Okay.
A comma. Okay, it's comma. But even the word then there, the word then makes it sound like that is part of his instruction or part of his command. Now, it is part of the whole command. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's not part of the command. But the thrust of this little section right here, what is it?
You can't take her back after she's got another man.
Right. Wife. Yes. I didn't even pick up on it until you... Right. The real thrust of this whole command, it's a whole... There's a bunch of scenarios. If he finds some indecency in her, and then he gives her a certificate of divorce, and then she goes away and she marries somebody else, what's the real command? Verse 4, her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife since she has become defiled. You know, that's just the thrust of the command. A husband, once his ex-wife becomes another man's wife, the first husband could never ask her to or accept her return. The certificate of divorce is somewhat of an aside here. I say somewhat. I'm not saying that it's not in there. I'm just saying the real thrust of it. Now, why do I bring that up? Because who emphasizes that part, the certificate of divorce, and misses the rest of it? The Pharisees, right?
The question Jesus, they emphasize the certificate of divorce.
That's right.
That's all they emphasize.
Exactly. If you asked a Jew, all he read was verse 1 and that only part of it.
Yeah, if I don't like the certificate of divorce, you're gone.
Cool. Right. Okay, so that's just the thrust so that we have that in mind when we get to Matthew 19 and Mark 10 and other places. You know, are the Pharisees wrong? What's going on with the Pharisees? What's going on there? Well, we now have a little bit better understanding of how they approached it the wrong way, okay? If that will help us in our understanding, I don't know. That's not really the point. But about no favor or something indecent, verse 1, she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency. What exactly is that indecency? Well, I know it is not adultery. Because if she is an adulterer, then she is put to death, not divorced. At least that's what the law says. Not that they're consistent in application, but that's what the law says. It is not even suspicion of adultery, because if it's adultery, she's put to death. If it's suspicion of the adultery, that's not grounds for the divorce. That's where he goes to Numbers chapter 5 and says there's this whole ordeal. I'm suspicious of you. If it turns out to be adultery, then she's stoned. But if it turns out not to be adultery, he's got to keep her the rest of his days. So it's not just suspicion of adultery. It's not suspicion of not being a virgin. You told me that you were a virgin, and then I married you and find out that you're not a virgin. Well, if she's not, she's stoned. And if she is, then it's just suspicion, and he's got to keep her all of his life. Okay. So it's not any of those things. It's not just anything either. Some Jewish writers suppose that the offensive breath might have been just ground for divorce. You've got bad breath. Yeah? Yes. That's because he was merciful.
Yeah. Is it possible that it may have been in there? That possibility may have been because he was merciful.
Okay. But if you go from Deuteronomy 22, verse 20, if the charge is true, the girl is not found to be a virgin, they shall bring the girl to the doorway and stone her to death. So what I said a second ago is, I said they were not consistent in their application, and we get that. I mean, we understand that the later the law is. In fact, by the time you come to Malachi, something different's going on. I don't claim to have all the answers here. I'm just trying to rule out from Genesis through Deuteronomy, what is he talking about by some indecency? Not just anything, because in Malachi 2, what does God yell at the Israelites for? Divorce. If they could divorce for just anything, like bad breath, then they wouldn't have been treating the wife of their youth treacherously. So it's not just anything. So, what is it? Some loathsome distemper of body or quality of mind. That's just a guess. Nobody really knows. The Mishnah, which is a later commentary on Jewish tradition, really, and the Torah. The Mishnah says if somebody was turned out to be what we would have called retarded a few years ago. You know, this something happened, maybe they're bonked on the head and lost their mind. You have grounds for divorce. There are records of that kind of thing happening. And the Mishnah will justify it from Deuteronomy 24. So it's that kind of thing that the Mishnah understands, okay? What was that movie where the girl falls in love with the guy who's got the wife up in the tower? Jane Eyre? Is that what it is? Jane Eyre. So if this were under the Old Testament, Jane Eyre, he could have divorced her, and everything would have been happily ever after. Okay? If this is true. You know, we don't know what the something indecent was. It's not adultery. It's less than that. But it's more than just anything. That's all I can tell you. I can't add to that. So, by the time we come to the New Testament, of course, there is a big...
Yeah, let's not go there yet.
Okay.
What is your opinion on what the point of the certificate of divorce itself is?
Okay.
Is it a legal document so that she cannot be charged with adultery when she's remarried? I mean, it's, in a sense, it is a thing that you are free from me. I've got no claim on you anymore, and you're free to go marry another man without my intervention. Is that how
yeah.
you see it?
I would say it's a legal document, and one of the benefits is what you just stated.
Okay. I have another question regarding that. What is your point of the beginning of the certificate of divorce? I'm going to decide. You mentioned that the Pharisees were putting the emphasis on the wrong part of this. Well, what were the Pharisees saying?
They were like they took it as license to divorce for any reason. All you got to do is give her the certificate and you're good to go.
Okay. So they're putting emphasis on the power of the certificate.
Right.
In the, I knew what they were saying, but I couldn't figure out how you were. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And maybe earlier, and maybe they should have got it by Malachi, and I don't know. There's some evolution, as the term we use often nowadays, some evolution that God expects in there, or at least they understood what God expected, and we're missing something. At least it's that much.
So, an example of the false attitude they have would be that if he had a reason to divorce her, or he took any reason to divorce her, but didn't actually handle the certificate, then if they were consistent, they would have a problem with that meeting.
Yes.
Okay.
Right, if they're consistent. Okay, so by the time we get to the New Testament, there's obviously a big change, right? In the Old Testament, it's not adultery, she's stoned. In the New Testament, it's not just anything, but it's not adultery. It's something else. In the New Testament, it's only adultery. That's the only time divorce is granted, right? Matthew 19, 1 through 9, Mark 10. Well, it's actually not Mark 10, but Matthew 5. For any reason at all. They come for any reason at all because their discussion in by the time Jesus is alive, the school of Shammai said a man may not divorce his wife unless he found some unchastity in her. By the way, so some of them lived a high standard, which the law would teach, right? The school of Hillel, he may divorce her even if she spoiled a dish for him. Rabbi Akba says he may divorce her even if he found another fairer than she. I like her better, time to get rid of the old one. And he didn't want to add one, he just got rid of her. Okay? So that's their mindset. They're approaching Jesus with, for any reason at all, just give her a certificate and you're good to go. And he says, not at all for any reason at all in the future. It's going to be only for adultery. Now, let me say this also. So, except for immorality, a much stricter why. Why can we divorce? Well, it's much stricter. And by the way, in 1 Corinthians 7:10, it says, if a woman leaves, let her remain single or be reconciled. Now, what if she leaves, gets married to somebody she should not be married to, because of her unlawful divorce. She gets out of that marriage. She's then single. Should she get remarried to her husband? Should she try to? In the Old Testament, it's an abomination.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question.
In the New Testament, I cannot say it's an abomination because some things change. Like this word abomination, go ahead.
But God showed you what he thought about it in Deuteronomy. That does have to play into it.
Okay, but he also said that marrying a sister is an abomination. You know, so I'll tell you what I do. He's taking the more God said this, so be careful, and I'm not saying it's wrong. I'll just counter with I tend to think that God thought of that way for that time. I could be wrong. It could be longer than that. God also still thinks of it that way. But I don't read it, so that's where I am.
In Corinthians 7:10, are we talking about a woman who has been married a second time and is returning to the first?
Right.
Okay.
We're kind of putting her and lifting her into this Deuteronomy 24.
There would be no concern about a woman who divorced, remained single, and then remarried her husband.
Right.
Okay.
That's clear as day.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not arguing one way or the
other. No, I know.
It's interesting to think about.
Yeah.
Because this is what God said back then. You know, this is how he thinks about it. So.
That's all I wanted to say on this. There are some changes, some big changes. That's all, really. Comment or question?
What about, was it the email the other day with the argument about the exception does not count because it's fornication that's mentioned, not adultery? Did you see if you, that's not ringing any bell, I must have read it somewhere else to talk to you about it.
It rings no bell, okay. Not from an email the other day, let me say that. And I'll stop there. Okay. All right, so we'll go on with our lovely answers. All right, chapter 31. What was Moses no longer able to do? Tanya? Sorry?
Lead.
Okay. Come and go. Who was told to be strong and courageous and why? George Bosworth? Sorry? Yeah, anybody else? Yeah. Joshua and the people. What were the Levites to do with the law and when? Marcy, are you? No, okay. Gary, please.
They were to obviously read it in the hearing of all Israel at the year of release of the Feast of Tabernacles, and also to keep the site dark.
Yeah.
That's part of the reading only.
No, that's right. By the way, I shut off the air conditioning the other day, and if anybody else is warm, you might want to take note of that. You didn't turn it back on, did you? Oh, there you go. Oh, did you? Okay. What was Israel going to do? John Bosworth, please.
Follow foreign gods.
And why write this song, Jonathan? Let's see. John Moore, are you ready to go? Okay, Tanya, please. Yes, to serve as a witness. What were the Levites to place? Where were the Levites to place the law? Gary already answered it. Answer it again, please.
Beside the ark.
Yeah, beside the ark. By the way, the Levites. Okay, so they take this law, whatever form it's in, and they put it by or in or by the Ark of the Covenant. Where's the Ark?
Most holy place.
Most holy place. Who gets to go there and how often?
Priests
once a year. So how do they get? I mean, it's not like we have Bibles everywhere, right? Did they have Bibles everywhere? No. So how do they get to know the law? I mean, because really they're supposed to know the law. How do they get to know it?
The Levites.
The Levites. The Levites are to teach it.
The king was to write it, so he had to get a hold of it somewhere.
King, right. King has it. The Levites teach it. Now, where are the Levites? Where do they live? Everywhere. Get the point? God's no dumb cookie, is he? All the nation needs to know the law. And guess where the law is? in all the nation. It's not just down there in Jerusalem. Oh, I got to get in my car and drive 3 hours to Jerusalem to figure out what the law is. Here is a map of Jerusalem, and that's what it would look like, right? You know, if you consider the law to be a light, you know, everywhere the Israelites are. I said Jerusalem, Israel, you get the point. So there's my nice little depiction. For how long did I bring that up? Because it took me forever to figure that out. I don't know how old I was when I finally realized, wait a minute, the Levites were everywhere. That's a great plan. Okay. For how long did Moses speak the words of the song? John Bosworth, did you get that one?
Until they were finished.
Until they were finished. You mixed concrete not too long ago, and then you let it cure. Did you start working on it before it cured? No, mistake, right? Ladies, you bake bread. I know that if you're like my wife, if I go in there and even joke or hint about not letting it rise as long as it needs to, you're going to slap your husband's. Okay? Because I don't mean that really, but okay. That's the look I get, right? If you're working with a computer, do you let the software, how much of the software do you install? The operating system, like half of it or three quarters or the whole thing? Because otherwise it's not going to work, right? The point being, how much of Scripture is inspired so that we may be adequate, equipped for every good work? All of it. Not you know, if we don't have the Old Testament, guess what? We're not going to be thoroughly equipped, so on and so forth. Chapter 32, what was the teaching like? Drops of rain is what verse 2 had said. I know we've had too much rain this year, but when you live in the desert, what do you want?
Rain.
Yes, you've lived in the desert. It's nourishing, it's refreshing, you run out. My children even run out. Go ahead. No. Right. And our attitude really should be, he's saying these words, God designed the words for the people. And this is really how we should be thinking of God's word. Wow, I can't wait to get my hands on the next time I'm able to set aside a little bit of time to read a little bit. Boy, when I feel better when I'm done with that. What had Israel done, and what question is asked of Israel? Gary, please.
They corrupted themselves. Is God not your father?
Yeah.
Who made you and established you? I mean, he's done everything for you.
Yeah, you summarized verse 5. That is question 5. After Israel rebelled, what did the Lord do to them? George?
I do not have my answer.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Spurned them.
Yes, 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 you're right. Yep, yep. I didn't read my own answer. To what degree was Israel destroyed, and why wasn't Israel completely destroyed? Gary, please. Tanya, I keep on forgetting anybody. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Gary, go ahead, finish.
Okay, until their power was gone. Yes, destroyed them to the point that until their power was gone. They broke them, kind of in a sense.
Yeah.
Why were they completely destroyed? God had compassion on them.
Anybody else? Yeah.
Him that can do the things that he can do, protect
them
and guard them.
Yeah. I'll bring them to an inch of their life and then bring them back also. Anybody, anything? Gary, you.
He had to maintain or fulfill the promises he kept to the patriarchs and David. Right?
Okay. Yes, he did. And there's something else in here?
Bring along a savior.
No. Anybody? Okay. Verse 27. Where am I? I got to get to the right book. Deuteronomy 30, where are we, 32?
The
exactly. His reputation. That's what I have written down. Not that the other answers were incorrect, but that was the specific one I was looking for. Sorry? In verse 26, I will cut them to pieces. I will remove the memory, verse 27, had I not feared the provocation by the enemy that their adversaries would misjudge, that they would say, our hand has done this. So when Babylon comes along, why didn't Babylon completely wipe them out? Because God knew Babylon would think, we did it. And God's saying, oh no, I stopped you just short so you would know I was in complete control, which is basically the point others were making. We're going to skip around some because we don't need to spend all day answering the questions. Question 8, the second part of it, how had Levi proved himself, and what was he thinking at the time? Tanya, did you get that? Yes. Okay, thinking loyalty. Do you have a verse that you have written? Do you write down verses? That's okay. Does anybody else have, what was he thinking at the time?
It says that he was in trouble in Egypt.
Coming out of Egypt.
Is he thinking back to Exodus 32?
I believe so.
When Levi stood for the Lord, Moses said, you know, he who's on the Lord's side, come stand with me.
Okay, I think that was the event that he's referring to, but the chapter says what he basically says what he was thinking.
I think maybe what you're getting at is that he was thinking it's better to follow God and ignore family.
Yes. And where are you?
Well, that's in like verse 9 or something.
Yeah.
So his father and mother, I regard them not. He disowned his brothers and ignored his children, for they observed your word and kept your covenant.
Right. Okay. So, yes, that is what I was getting at. Sorry, that's a difficult one. He didn't consider his own family. I'm going to read that one more time. Verse 9. Yes, it appears to have been in Exodus 32 when they make the golden calf. And Moses says, everybody who's for the Lord, come with me. And all the Levites ran to him. And they started slaughtering their own brothers, and I forget how many died that day, but many died because the Levites took their swords and killed their family. Okay, here we have some inspired commentary on what I questioned is what's going on inside of his mind. Deuteronomy 33:9, who said of his father and his mother, I do not consider them. And he did not acknowledge his brothers, nor did he regard his own sons, for they observed your word and kept your covenant. So this is what's going on inside the mind of the Levites while they're out there slaughtering their own family for God's word. Okay, regardless of any time someone in Israel sins and someone else in Israel comes along, like we'll see this in Judges a couple times, and starts slaughtering their own brothers for God, what they're doing is putting God above their family. New Testament passage come to mind, put God above the family. Don't fear he who can kill the body, but fear the one who can kill the body and soul. Goes on to say, if you love your parents more than you love God, then you hate, in essence, you're hating Jesus. So that's Matthew chapter 10, other places also. So we have here in Levi an illustration of that very principle. Any other comments or questions on what we're talking about here, these questions? Well, what did you answer? God was...
I thought you meant God.
Yeah, wow, I didn't even pick up on that, huh? Okay. Okay, so, getting into the text here. Deuteronomy chapter 29 is, Israel is going to leave the Lord. Chapter 30, Israel's going to leave the Lord. The Lord's going to bring them back. Chapter 30 is the end of the law, really. Verse 15, Deuteronomy 30:15. I have set you before you today life and prosperity, death and adversity. He's saying, make your choice. I've given it to you today. You know exactly what you need to do and what the outcomes will be, so make a decision. All right. Moses is basically done working. He gets to retire now. Chapter 31. Moses went and spoke these words to all Israel. And he said to them, I am 120 years old today. I am no longer able to come and go. The Lord has said, you shall not cross this Jordan. Okay, so Moses is stepping aside here. Verse 3. It is the Lord your God who will cross ahead of you. So I'm not going to go anymore. You'll go. The Lord will cross ahead of you. He will destroy these nations before you, so on and so forth. Then in verse 7, Moses called Joshua and said to him, be strong and courageous, for you shall go with this people into the land. All right, the expression, the idiom, pass the buck. What's that term mean? If you're passing the buck, what does it mean? Yeah, you're blaming somebody else, right? You're not taking accountability. By the way, do you think Moses ever passed the buck? Do you think he never took responsibility for his own actions? When I read Moses, I get the impression of a guy who said, when he sinned, Lord, I have sinned, right? Okay, here's another expression. Passing the baton, handing off the baton, what is that talking about? Right, track runners. It's this guy's turn to start running, and I'm done running. Okay, what we have here is Moses passing the baton from himself to Joshua. In fact, later on it'll say that Moses laid his hands on Joshua, and some of the spirit went to Joshua, right? Okay, so Moses is, it's a handoff from himself to Joshua. Don't look up there real quick. Whoops. Don't especially look there. All right. So, Moses had been leading the people how long? 40 years. Do you remember, how does it begin? He comes in, where are they? Egypt. What do they want? Out. What does he do?
He comes in looking like God.
Exactly. Comes in looking like God. When they look at this guy, now they know better, but the idea is he's looking like God. In fact, God said, you will be like me, and Aaron will be like a prophet to you, right? Okay, so he leads them out. Then later on in Exodus chapter 18, if any of them had a problem, where did they go? Why? Because he was dumb? Because he knew what was going on. He's a smart guy. All right, so Exodus 19 and 20, thunder on the mountain, very, very frightening. Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening. Okay, on the mountain here, here's God's on the mountain, and all of Israel says what? You go. Please, Moses, you go. And we can go on and on and on. Exodus 32, God says, they have been sinful. I'm going to destroy them. And Moses says what? Please, God, don't. Over and over and over. Their man is going away. How would you feel? Right? When Jesus, who's been with his disciples for how long? 3.5 years, says he's going away, how do they feel? Moses is going away. So it's devastating for these people. But at the same time, it was never about Moses, for Moses. Remember Numbers chapter 12, he is the most humble man in the world. If you counted the times it said Lord or he, referring to the Lord, in this little section, 18 times. I'm going away, and the rest of it is about what God is going to do for you. Because it never was about Moses. Not for Moses. It was always for God. So his point is this, really. His point is, number one, I'm just a servant. This is the Paul, Apollos. Somebody comes along and says, I'm a Paul. I'm of Apollos. And Paul says, look, don't say that. You've got it all wrong. We're just servants. Right? Never forget that attitude. No matter how big we are, what we're doing, we're only servants of God. But his point is this. Move on. Moses is going to die. Move on. Because after all, the main character, when the main character of a story dies, what happens to the story? It's over. The main character just died, didn't he? No. God didn't die, because Moses wasn't the main character as much as he was a main character. In fact, Moses will be repeated, that name will come up 200 more times in your Bibles. So, Moses did die, he didn't die, because he's still going to live on in his word, but it doesn't matter. God is the main character. And this is what Moses is saying. He's saying, look, the Lord is going to lead you. Go on with your life in faithfulness. Make sure it's in faithfulness. Now, Moses dies. What if somebody responded, well, Moses is gone, so I think I'll stop being a Yahwehist now, a Jehovahist. Moses isn't around anymore, so I'm just going to quit this religion. What does that say about that person? Sorry, they're following the wrong person is exactly what you just said. They're following the wrong person. Right. This is not about Moses. It's not about later on. It won't be about Paul, right? The apostles after Jesus left, it is about Jesus, but the point I'm really making right here in this sentence is, did the apostles quit when Jesus left? No. Later on, when the apostles leave, what did Titus and Timothy do? Quit? You keep on going on. Here's one that's out of the box. Sewell and Bill Hall. Many of you know them. These guys are soldiers, right? Their father was a soldier. When he passed on, did they quit? No. So here's another question for us. What about us after our parents And I realize that several among us, our parents, are not Christians. But you had somebody teach you, somebody that you love. What happens when they go on? When my mom, and the older I get, the more I realize, you know, I'm going to be quote-unquote alone not too long from now. It'll be some years. Don't tell mom and dad I said that. But you get it. You know, I mean, it's already August, and it's not August yet. So you see? Time flies the older you get. It's not going to be very long. You know, when my mom and dad are gone, and then tick off these older people you know who have helped you to be who you're going to be. And when they're gone, and it's just you, what do? Quit? Be strong and courageous, and it will happen to every single one of us in here. It will happen. Your time will come for you to be the only one. Your parents are going to be gone sometime. Your friends, whoever they are, whoever helped you to be. In fact, the writer of Hebrews will quote this, be strong and courageous. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5. The point is, make sure that your character is free from the love of money. So don't love money. Well, why not? Give me some motivation. Being content with what you have. For, Hebrews 13, 5. For he himself said, I will never desert you or forsake you. And that's a quote from Deuteronomy 31, 6 right there. So we have the same promise and the same obligation that they had then. Comments or questions on this?
Turn back to Hebrews 12.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. And I don't know that we necessarily have to understand every bit of the consciousness of a person who has died.
Right.
And everything else. But there's still that issue of, you know, in a sense, I'm being watched.
Right.
By people who have expectations of me.
And you're not alone.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I was saying you're alone. Physically, you might be, but spiritually, I don't know if we're being watched. I don't think so. But whatever it is, the point is God's watching, and there's a whole. But everybody's been there, done that, and they kept on going, and we have to too. It said that He will not fail you. In Deuteronomy 31, be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or tremble at them, for the Lord your God is the one who goes with you. Deuteronomy 31, verse 6. He will not fail you or forsake you. The second part is He's not going to leave you alone. You'll be okay. He will not forsake you. He says it twice. The end of verse 8. Do not fear or be dismayed, because He will not fail you or forsake you. He's not going to leave you. And He won't fail you either. If I said Hiroshima, that conjures up in images. What does it conjure up? Hiroshima. Yeah, and nothing. Right? Mushroom cloud and then cloud and then devastation. Okay, so those are the images. What are the implications of the A-bomb? A-bomb? A-bomb. In Hiroshima, right? What are the implications? The implications are 9 days later, what happened? The end of the war. The Japanese called up and said, if you can do that, we don't want to mess with you. He won't fail you. Just as He did to Sihon and Og. What happened to them? They knew. We read it. And He's saying, look, God can do it. And He will do it for you every time. They're about to go with... Sihon and Og are the first of the first three. Excuse me, the second and third of the first three enemies that Israel conquered. And they're not even in the land yet. The point is, the work is about to start. But don't worry. Because just like God did to them, God will do for you forever and ever. So, always keep this in mind. If you're feeling alone or defeatist, have a defeatist attitude, remember Sihon and Og and what God has done for you in your life. There are things where I can look at and say, I'm convinced God did that. Number one being, He saved me from my sins. If He'll do that for me, then I'm going to be okay as long as I keep on being faithful. Comments or questions?
I guess the first one would be that starting with Moses here, maybe I'll go around and just one thing. There's no room for charisma in this leadership when you are young. Okay, you cannot afford to be proud of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Afraid that the people will start following you. And when you are old... I mean, by the time that these people you're talking about have left us, guess who's the one that that should be the one that everybody else is now going, what are we going to do when this person leaves us? You know, and there you are.
Yeah.
You know, at that point. And there's just no room for personality there, because either when you're young and tempted to do this thing, or when you're old, there's still a fact you're going to be gone, and these people are going to have to do something. You know, and it just leaves no room whatsoever for those people to be enjoying you on behalf of your own personality.
Yeah, I'm just a servant, no matter where we are.
We're good.
Oh, that's great. Okay, we'll go on for at least a few more minutes. Sorry that it's taking longer than I thought it would. Okay, so Deuteronomy 31. We're still in Deuteronomy 31. Moses is about to die. Verse 15, verse 16. Moses, the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, you are about to lie down with your fathers, and this people will rise and play the harlot with strange gods in the land into the midst which they are going. It will forsake me, break my covenant which I have made with them." Okay, we already knew that from having read Deuteronomy 28, 29, 30, and 30. Well, 30. We already knew they're going to leave him. He's not telling us anything new now. They're going to leave me. Verse 17, "Then my anger will be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them and hide my face from them, and they will be consumed, and many evils and troubles will come upon them, so that they will say in that day." Okay, stop here. We've already read everything so far. They're going to leave me, and I'm going to reject them. Now, this is about to get a little bit new. They're going to say in that day, "Is it not because our God is not among us that these evils have come upon us?" Okay, so later on in Babylon, Assyria, and other places, they're going to be thinking, "Why is this happening to us?" And they're going to come up with, "God isn't among us anymore. That's why it's God." Now listen to what he says. Verse 18, "I will surely hide my face in that day because of all the evil which they will do." Verse 19, "Therefore, write this song for yourselves. Teach it to the sons of Israel. Put it on their lips, so that this song may be a witness for me against the sons of Israel." Look in verse 21. "It shall come about, when many evils and troubles have come upon them, that this song will testify before them as a witness, for it shall not be forgotten." Okay, they're going to be enduring suffering. They're going to say, why? They're going to say, God. And God's going to have a song that he's prepared for them 750 or more years earlier. It's going to be witnessing against them while they're going through this. Okay, so what is the song? We'll read part of the song. We're going to outline it. First of all, the first part of the song is the cause for their curse. They're thinking, hey, wait a minute. This is happening to us because of God. Verse 4 of chapter 32. "The rock, his work is perfect." You don't need to read more. What's that saying? It's not God's fault. Whatever's going on is not God's fault. "For all his ways are just." There, said it again. So what's the only alternative? Verse 5. "They have acted corruptly. They are not his children because of their defect. They are perverse and crooked generation." Why are you here? This is in the song. So 750 years later, when they're going through all this, why is it? If they only sing that song, they'll know exactly why it is. By the way, Isaiah, if you read the whole book of Isaiah, who are they always blaming? God. God's left us. He's forsaken us. He can't help us if he tried to. And then there's the famous passage which says that your sins have made a separation. This is the exact same complaint they're making there. So first there's the cause. Then there's the perversity of their perversity. We'll read this. Chapter 32, 6, the second half. "Is not he your father who has bought you?" Bought? What kind of language is that? Slavery. You were a slave. "I bought you to freedom," is his point. "He has made you and established you. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of all generations. Ask your father. He will inform you, your elders, and they will tell you. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of man, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the sons of Israel. The Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is an allotment of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land and in a howling waste of a wilderness. He encircled him. He cared for him. He guarded him as the pupil of his eye. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that hovers over its young, he spread his wings and caught them. He carried them on his pinions. The Lord alone guided him, and there was no foreign god with him. He made him ride high on the high places of the earth. He ate the produce of the field. He made him suck honey from the rock, oil from the flinty rock, curds of cows and milk of the flock, with fat of lambs and rams and breed of Bashan and goats, the finest of the wheat and the blood of the grapes. You drank wine. Wow, what a life. Look in chapter 32, verse 5. They have acted corruptly toward him. If you were looking at a father and a son, and the father had given everything to the son, but the son rejected the father, kicked him, spit in his face. If you thought about the son, what would you think? How could you? If you thought about the father, what would you think? I'm not surprised that he kicked the son out of the house. Verse 5, they acted corruptly. Verse 6, do you thus repay the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? He's saying, look, you guys have blown it. You're crazy for having done what you did. A couple more. The wrath of their Redeemer, verse 15. Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. It's a pun. You are grown fat, thick, and sleek. They forsook God who made him. Verse 16. They made him jealous with strange gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. And here it comes. We'll skip down. Verse 22. A fire is kindled in my anger and burns from the lowest part of Sheol, consumes the earth with its yield, and sets on fire the foundations of the mountains. I will heap misfortunes on them. I will use my arrows on them. They will be wasted by famine, consumed by plague, bitter destruction. The teeth of beasts I will send upon them, the venom of crawling things of the dust. Outside the sword will bereave, inside terror. The young man and the virgin, the nursling and the man of gray hair. I would have said, I will cut them to pieces. I will remove the memory of them from men. That is how angry he is. He is ready to wipe them off the face of the earth. The only reason he doesn't here is because he's afraid of his reputation. That it will be, he'll be mistaken. Right? The point is they rejected God and he got angry. Okay, so is that really just? Okay, the rest of it we'll deal with that. We're just going to read one part. The one part is verse 39. See now that I am he, and there is no God besides me. It is I who put death and give life. I have wounded, and it is I who heals, and there is no one who can deliver from my hand. He's saying, look, you guys ran after other gods. That was ridiculous. I am the only God. By the way, the God who gives life and death has authority, right? To make up any rules he wants to. And he had told them, here are the rules. And if you break the rules, this is what's going to happen to you. So when 750 years later, you break the rules and this is what happened to you, don't be surprised. And guess what? It's reasonable for me to do that. Verse 41, my hand takes hold of justice. He said, look, this is only reasonable. It's not my fault. It's your fault. And everything that's happened to you, you can't blame me saying I'm an unfair God because I told you everything that would happen and here it's happening. I am a perfectly fair God is what he's saying. The last point I'll make is thank God he has a reputation to maintain. Because if he didn't, you know, you caught that in there. We read it earlier. I would have said I'll cut them to pieces, but the enemies and the adversaries, they would say our hand is triumphant and the Lord has not done all this. And he can't have that. Thank God he has a reputation to maintain. Otherwise, what? We'd all be dead. So he saves them. He saves them. Did they deserve it? What's that called when you give something they don't deserve, something to somebody that they don't deserve?
Grace.
Mercy. Grace. If you don't give something they do deserve, that's mercy. He didn't give them what they did deserve. That's mercy. And then he also gave them what they didn't deserve. Just the other side of the coin. He gave them something. He gave them salvation. They didn't deserve that. That's his grace. So, again, we see the same God in the Old and the New Testament. We've gone a little long, and we're not done. Comments or questions?